Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Smithsonian Magazine here on OWL Radio. I always include in my introduction a little description of Smithsonian Magazine, and just to remind the listeners that it covers topics that range from anthropology and agriculture to pop culture, justice and medical issues, sports. We're going to start off today, though, with one that is sort of a combination of history and archaeology. So let's see what they have to say. This is from the September 2022 issue of Smithsonian. The Forever Legend. And many, many people are fascinated with the idea, the story of King Arthur and the Round Table. And that's what this is about. It was written by Joshua Hammer. The subtitle is The Story of Arthur and His Knights of the Round Table has captivated us for 1,000 years. But was the historic British monarch a real person? New research is reviving debate. Interesting. Kind of a teaser entrance to the article. A cold, wind-driven rain soaks through my parka as I walk across a narrow footbridge that links the Cornwall mainland in southwest England to a rocky promontory overlooking the Bristol Channel. Far below this cantilevered span, waves crash against the cliffs and swirl inside a grotto known as Merlin's Cave. Windscut, a burly, amiable archaeologist from nearby Devon, opens a gate and leads me down a path to the ruins of a medieval castle. Its fragmentary walls mark the lair where Richard, the 13th century Earl of Cornwall and the brother of King Henry III, is said to have gathered with his followers to feast on mutton and ale and pay homage to a monarch who may never have existed, King Arthur. The figure of Arthur first appeared in Welsh poetry in the late 6th and early 7th century, a hero who was said to lead the Britons in battle against Saxon invaders. But it wasn't until the 12th century that he was first tied to this dramatic headland, known as Tintagel. In the Welsh cleric Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, which was written in 1136 and purported to trace Britain's history back to its supposed founding by Trojan exiles, an almost certainly fictitious 6th century British king named Uther Pendragon, sleeps with a beguiling Egerna, the wife of a local duke, at her castle in Tintagel, after the magician Merlin turns Pendragon into a likeness of her husband. That night she conceived Arthur, the most famous of men who subsequently won great renown by his outstanding bravery, Geoffrey wrote. Scholars have universally dismissed Geoffrey's text as a pseudo-history, woven from ancient Welsh folk tales and his febrile imagination. Still, many people at the time believed the story, and Richard, Earl of Cornwall, was so convinced Arthur was real that in May 1233, he traded 3 prime estates for this treeless headland, which is separated from the mainland by an isthmus, and built a castle on it. It had no function, Scott says, as he leads me through the stone ruins of the castle's great hall. It's in a remote part of Cornwall that had no use to him, but he wanted to anchor his position in legend and history. He was the Earl of Cornwall, but he was also the successor of Arthur. King Arthur has never relinquished his hold on the imagination. Writers in Geoffrey's wake added their own flourishers. The magical sword Excalibur, the Knights of the Round Table, Arthur's romantic triangle with Queen Guinevere and Sir Lancelot, and Arthur's mortal wound at the Battle of Camlann. Arthurian tales of courtly love, magic, and martial bravery have been told and retold in countless versions over the centuries, from the earliest eulogistic stanzas in Welsh poetry to T.H. White's 1958 novel, The Once and Future King, from Sir Thomas Malory's 15th century Le Mort d'Arthur to the 2021 film The Green Knight, starring Dev Patel as Sir Gawain, a knight at Camelot, the legendary castle where Arthur held court. There is something in the Arthur legend for everyone, says Leah Tether, a professor of medieval studies at Bristol University and former president of the British branch of the International Arthurian Society, which regularly brings together scholars and other enthusiasts interested in Arthurian literature. The story of King Arthur, she says, has got flawed characters with whom we can empathize, quests to achieve impossible goals, and an adaptable storyline that fits the socio-political landscape of the time, Raluca Redulescu, a professor of medieval literature at Bangor University in Wales, suggests. Arthur's perennial appeal is also tied to a standard of moral integrity that readers find inspirational, one they cannot find in the world around them, but will discover in the stories of King Arthur. The timeless popularity of the Arthur legend has overshadowed a central unresolved question. Was there really a King Arthur, or at least a historical prototype upon whom Geoffrey's hero is based? That's what has brought me to Tintagel on this stormy winter morning. Scott leads me down a grassy slope to the foundations of a dozen houses built on terraces overlooking the sea. Raleigh Radford, the English archaeologist who exposed these ruins in the 1930s, was reminded of similar structures at remote sites in Ireland, and after observing Christian symbols on ceramics found at the site, he guessed the ruins were the remains of a Celtic monastery that existed between the 5th and 7th centuries. Over the past 5 years, however, Scott and his team from English Heritage, a nonprofit organization that administers more than 400 historical sites in Britain, have conducted their own research, and they've challenged Radford's assessment of the site. They have excavated three additional structures and have also unearthed fragments of glass goblets from Spain, cups from Merovingian-era France, pottery from Tunisia, and amphorae likely from Turkey used for storing wine or olive oil. Carbon dating, unavailable to Radford a century before, has confirmed the settlement existed in the 6th century. But rather than being a retreat for religious ascetics, Scott believes that the site, with its protected position on the Cornwall coast, was a flourishing local stronghold. This could have been home to a mercantile elite whose economy was based entirely on trade, he says. Tintagel, Scott says, was likely home to hundreds or even thousands of people and controlled a territory that extended across modern-day Cornwall. He points out that while much of the British Isles has sunk into illiteracy and destitution during this period, commonly known as the Dark Ages, most residents at Tintagel lived in comfortable, slate-roofed homes with sturdy wooden timbers and, in some cases, a second story. It's not implausible, he argues, that a ruler or a commander, perhaps one named Arthur, rose out of this society and served as an inspiration for Geoffrey of Monmouth. The headland has given up other tantalizing clues, including a 6th-century stone slab with the mysterious word Artognu, and that's A-R-T-O-G-N-O-U, carved into it. Experts in Celtic, the language spoken in Britain at the time, dismiss its significance. But some insist the inscription is a variation of Arthur. The slab, they say, is a mark of the king's reign. When the legend of Arthur was born, Britain was in a state of collapse. The Roman Empire had made its first incursion into the British Isles in 55 BC, eventually conquering much of the territory up to present-day Scotland. Its conquest and long rule was often violent, but the Romans also built roads and established towns such as Londinium and Duravernum, Catiacorum, today London and Canterbury. Throughout the Roman province of Britannia, the quality of life largely improved. Then, in AD 410, Rome, under siege at home from Visigoths, a Germanic tribe from Eastern Europe, withdrew its troops and plunged Britannia into chaos. Civil institutions vanished, the economy collapsed, and basic household goods became scarce. Saxon invasions terrorized the population, and Britannica fragmented into fiefdoms dominated by often brutal strongmen and their gangs. Britain has kings, but they are tyrants engaged in plunder and rape, always preying on the innocent, a British monk named Gildas wrote in the 6th century. Famine and plague struck the region, wiping out a significant part of the population. Britain was a failed state, says Mark Morris, a British historian and author of 2021's The Anglo-Saxons, A History of the Beginning of England, 400 to 1066. People would have perished in the hundreds of thousands. It was a miserable time to be alive. Many historians believe that a heroic warrior likely rose during this period to lead the Britons, who had largely embraced Christianity, against the pagan Saxons. The Welsh poem Y Gododdin, written between AD 540 and 640, describes a fallen soldier by likening him to another called Arthur, which some scholars interpret as showing that a warrior named Arthur was so famous when the poem was written that the bravery of others could be measured by comparison. Around the same time, Gildas the monk described a British triumph at the Battle of Badon Hill, which he dated to the year of my birth, probably in the early 6th century. He didn't mention Arthur. He called his hero Ambrosius Aurelianus. But 3 centuries later, around 830, a Welsh monk named Nennius, in his History of the Britons, described how a warrior named Arthur led the Britons to victory in 12 glorious battles against the Saxons. The 12th battle was on the mountain of Badon, in which there fell in one day 960 men from one charge of Arthur, and no one slew them except him alone. And in all battles he was the victor, Nennius wrote. Some have pointed to Nennius's account as evidence of Arthur's existence, yet Nicholas Higham, a retired medievalist at the University of Manchester and the author of 2018's King Arthur, The Making of a Legend, says the evidence is hardly conclusive. For one thing, the account was written 300 years after the Battle of Badon Hill was purported to take place, although Gildas' text provides the only contemporaneous mention of the battle. Other British histories, including the 8th century ecclesiastical History of the English People, describe the fighting in detail, and scholars are generally convinced that such a battle did take place. For another, historians in the Middle Ages are widely known to have blended fact and fiction to advance a political or religious agenda. At a time when the Saxons were conquering Britain, Higham says, the Britons needed a God-beloved warrior to rally their spirits and restore the emergent nation to glory, and Nennius concocted a character to fit the bill. Arthur was winning battles with the support of Jesus Christ and Mary against the Saxons, he says. The Saxons were presented as barbaric, dishonest, and latecomers to Christianity. To show that Arthur had roots in Roman culture, which was still widely admired, Higham argues, Nennius derived the name from Artorius, a general who gained fame in the Punic Wars in the 3rd century BC. If Nennius established Arthur as a British hero, Geoffrey of Monmouth brought him to life. Born around 1090, possibly in Wales, and educated in Paris and Oxford, Geoffrey was ensconced as a bishop in Britain in the mid-1100s when he wrote in Latin perhaps the most influential book ever about Arthur. Like Nennius, Geoffrey had a political agenda to show the superiority of the Celtic-speaking Britons and, by extension, the Welsh, who spoke the same language. There were a lot of criticisms of the Welsh as being savages and barbarians, said Morris. Geoffrey invents a noble history for them going back 100 years before Arthur. A cipher in Nennius' history, Arthur now became a Celtic-speaking warrior king within a richly imagined narrative. Geoffrey claimed that he'd gleaned details of Arthur's life from an ancient Welsh history book shown to him by an Oxford archdeacon, but there's no evidence such a book existed. There's also no knowledge about what might have led him to set Arthur's original story at Tintagel, or if he ever visited the remote headland. He would have known it as a very dramatic, rocky clifftop, a mystical place, a place that there were plenty of stories about, says Higham, but that's all we can say. Geoffrey introduced Guinevere's infidelity to Arthur, the wizard Merlin, a composite of earlier Welsh prophets, and a magical sword he called Caliburn, based on the Irish sword Caled Bogle, a derivation of the Welsh Cedulf, which later became known as Excalibur. He ended the tale on an island called Avalon, where Arthur is carried by the enchantress Morgan le Fay after being mortally injured against the Saxons in the Battle of Camlann. Geoffrey apparently plucked this battle from the Welsh Annals written in the late 10th century. This setup chronicles an apparent blend of fact and fiction established A.D. 537 as the year of the Battle of Camlann, in which Arthur and Medrow, or Mordred, who in later Arthurian tales became Arthur's treacherous nephew and rival, fell, and there was plague in Britain and Ireland. Geoffrey's fantastical account had its share of skeptics. It is quite clear that everything this man wrote about Arthur and his successors, and indeed his predecessors, was made up, the medieval historian William of Newburgh wrote. Yet many Britons accepted it as truth. In 1191, the monks of Glastonbury Abbey dug up a pair of skeletons in their churchyard and touted them as the remains of King Arthur and Queen Guinevere, a clever hoax to draw paying tourists to the abbey. By the 13th century, writes Morris in 2015's A Great and Terrible King, Edward I and the Forging of Britain, it was proof positive that the fabulous king about whom Geoffrey of Monmouth had written had once really existed. One true believer was King Edward I. In 1278, the monarch visited the gravesite at Glastonbury and ordered the remains to be disinterred, partly to lay to rest the belief in some quarters that Geoffrey's hero was superhuman and still alive, and thus could potentially challenge Edward for the throne. There, in two caskets, were found the bones of the said king of wondrous size and those of Guinevere of marvelous beauty, wrote a local observer. Afterward, the king and queen wrapped the skeletons in silk, placed the royal seal on them, and returned them to their graves. From this point, the Arthur legend not only grew but became the dominant literary tale of medieval Europe. Monasteries and royal courts bought more than 1,000 copies of Geoffrey's manuscript, making it the most popular text in the Middle Ages after the Bible. Richard Barber, an Arthurian scholar in Sussex, has personally tracked down 235 surviving copies. He might have found more, but when Henry VIII shuttered the country's monasteries in the 1530s during his break with the Roman Church, a lot of them were torn up and used for wrapping pies, Barber told me. Meanwhile, the legend of King Arthur traveled across the English Channel to France, thanks to the hugely influential 12th century French poet Chrétien de Troyes, possibly borrowing from Geoffrey of Monmouth and from Welsh folk tales, and writing under the patronage of the Plantagenets, the British-French dynasty founded by Henry II, de Troyes invented Sir Lancelot, Camelot, and the Holy Grail, which he described as a vessel used by Jesus at the Last Supper. The Arthur story began to take off, says Barber. 100 years later, you've got Arthur in Germany and all around Italy. Other writers added their own touches to the Arthur story and canonized his place in literary history. Thomas Malory, a British member of Parliament and a violent criminal who probably wrote Le Mort d'Arthur while doing time in Newgate Prison for robbery or rape, created the definitive version of the Sword in the Stone story. In his account, the teenage Arthur answers a challenge inscribed on the stone, "Whoso pulleth out the sword of this stone and anvil is rightwise king born of all England," by performing the feat multiple times after other nobles had failed. 4 centuries later, Alfred, Lord Tennyson, in Idylls of the King, described the tortured romantic triangle involving Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere that tore apart the Knights of the Round Table. "The great and guilty love he bare the queen, in battle with the love he bare his lord, had marred his face and marked it ere his time," he wrote. Tennyson also brought the story full circle. The Victorian poet described the waves of the British Channel carrying the infant Arthur, an abandoned castaway, to the shore of Tintagel. There Merlin stashes him in the grotto, now known as Merlin's Cave, to protect him from the enemies of his father, Uther Pendragon. As he had from the beginning, Arthur remained a source of legitimacy for Britain's ruling elite, where early medieval legends sought to cast Celtic-speaking Britons favorably. The Tudor monarchs, who came to power in the late 15th century, claimed Arthur as a direct ancestor, deriving from him the right to rule the nation. Henry VII even baptized his son Prince Arthur. As for writers, he remained the ideal vessel into which they could pour their social commentary. Tennyson, writing during the upheavals of the Industrial Revolution, portrayed Arthur as a figure of moral stability and certainty, whereas Guinevere, in the light of Victorian morality, was an adulterer whose transgressions contributed to the general sickness of society. The interesting thing about the Arthurian legend is that it has periods of both ebb and flow. It's able to be molded to fit with current preoccupations such that it can find applicability no matter what the mood of the moment. It has its roots in the Middle Ages. Stories were transmitted orally and via manuscripts, meaning that no two versions were identical. It's actually impossible to identify an original version of Arthur. Arthur's appeal is, and always was, precisely in his multiplicity. The investment of time and energy that scholars have put into the question of whether Arthur really lived, to say nothing of the enormous popularity of Arthurian tales through the ages, suggests that the pursuit goes far beyond narrow academic interest. Why are cryptic references in 1,500-year-old Celtic texts so tantalizing? Might it be they're a way of transcending humdrum reality and connecting to a glorious past and the possibility that deep in the mists of time, giants walked the earth? Wynn Scott, for his part, isn't ready to write off King Arthur just yet. The 5 years that he spent working here impressed on him the extraordinary nature of this Dark Ages enclave, he says, as we perch on a slope overlooking the crashing sea on a windswept morning. At a time when most Britons were struggling to find cooking utensils, Tintagel's inhabitants were using crucibles to forge metal, inscribing slabs with Celtic writing, and controlling agricultural production across substantial territory. The settlement would have been well defended against the marauding bands that plagued the mainland. Geoffrey of Monmouth noted that just a handful of warriors positioned at the narrow neck could have staved off an entire army. It is not difficult to envision a charismatic leader rising here to defend northern Cornwall from Saxon invaders, says Scott, or to imagine that his feats would enter 6th-century folklore and be passed down by storytellers to Geoffrey and other chronicles. We know this was a center of power, he says. But whose power was it? It's always going to remain a mystery. Well, isn't that a fascinating take on the history? It's not only history and archaeology, it's also literature, because of all the writings that had been done over the centuries about King Arthur and his legend and the additional stories that were added to it, about Lancelot, about Guinevere. And was it Rodgers and Hammerstein who created the musical Camelot? Not sure who did it, but certainly it was one of my favorite musicals of all time. And traveling to Cornwall makes it even more clear of what a fascinating area it is, and wild and remote. It is a beautiful part of Britain. Well, moving along, this is another totally different kind of more natural history, I guess, if you will. This is a hairy problem, and it's written by Katya Sengel. Bison on a California island represent one of Hollywood's weirdest legends. In 1924, during Hollywood's first golden age, 14 American bison arrived on Santa Catalina Island, 22 miles off the coast of Los Angeles. The animals were to appear in two movies being filmed on the island, The Vanishing American and The Thundering Herd, both adapted from Zane Grey novels. Alas, the animals didn't make it into the former, and we don't know if they played a part in the latter. The footage vanished long ago. But the bison remained, and some of their progeny finally made it to the big screen. In Stanley Kramer's 1971 Bless the Beasts and Children, descendants of the founding beasts still have star power, helping attract hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. But perhaps their most salient role over the decades is to bedevil conservationists. Today, the herd presents benefits and challenges for local ecology. Visitors take bison tours and enjoy bison burgers made from mainland meat and quaff buffalo milk cocktails featuring Kahlua, vodka, half and half, cream de cacao, and cream de banana, and no bison milk. Such tourism helps fund the nonprofit Catalina Island Conservancy, which controls 88% of the island and works to restore and protect native flora. At its peak in the 80s, that's the 1980s, the herd numbered 550, but some of them eventually, concerned about their health and ecological impact, shipped some of the bison off the island. And in a 2003 study, their shaggy coats carried plants that were, a study showed, imported, such as fennel, to places they wouldn't otherwise reach, disrupting endemic species like St. Catherine's lace. The study also found the bison were smaller and less fertile than their mainland counterparts, partly from persistent drought. So, evicting the herd was not an option because it would hurt island residents, 4,000 or so, many of whom rely on bison tourism. But wildlife management is not just about the wildlife. It's just also about the human context. So they have been very cautious in thinning the herd and relocating some of the bison to ensure the health of those who remain. So there's just a little take on a current problem after we have mostly talked about the legend of King Arthur. Well, you have been listening to Smithsonian on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page, owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed at after 9 o'clock this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.